They wore balaclavas, black as evil, with no eye holes. They stole guns, then they were trigger happy. People were going to die. Could investigators and forensic scientists identify the gunmen and put an end to their deadly spree? Enter the world of forensic science, the science of crime, where a suspect's guilt or innocence can hang on a single piece of evidence. On September 14, 1994, the lives of two women who had never met were forever and irreparably intertwined through a series of cold-blooded murders. Danielle Thomas and her husband Ken had come to Canada from South Africa to start a new life for themselves and their teenage daughter. Danielle worked in a dress shop. Ken was a carpenter. Whenever Ken worked late, he would let himself in, then come up to the bedroom and ask Danielle if she wanted coffee or tea. It was the small thing she would most remember. Natalie Pardee and her husband Roger had two teenage sons, and they were partners in every sense, both in their marriage and in their family-run gun shop. Natalie's last living memory of Roger was 20 minutes before the holdup. Around 5, a customer pulled into the store's parking lot and saw two armed figures wearing balaclavas. He scribbled down the car's license plate number and raced off to call police. The first gunman bounded into the store and yelled, "Get your hands in the air, this is a holdup." A shocked employee said, "You're kidding." The bandit answered, "I'm not kidding," and shot him in the arm. Then he whirled, wounded one customer and fired at another. Roger Pardee whispered into the phone, "Call the police, we're being held up." And he was shot point blank. Then the second gunman entered, shouting, "If anyone moves, kill him." He smashed a gun case and scooped out 11 handguns. The first gunman barked, "That's enough, let's go." In less than a minute, 4 people had been shot. One of them, Roger Pardee, was dead. Investigators learned that the balaclavas the gunmen wore didn't have eye holes, so no one could describe their ethnicity, their gender, not even the color of their eyes. What did register with the witnesses was the cold-bloodedness of the shorter of the two gunmen, the one who had done all the shooting. His gun had been equipped with a silencer, indicating he was anticipating using it. He hadn't fired a warning shot, never aimed below the torso, had no interest in the cash register. Instead, he had been fixated on clearing a path to the gun cabinet for his taller cohort, no matter the cost.
The brutality of it was striking. The intent of these robbers were to get what they wanted, and they had no hesitation about killing anyone.
After the victims were removed, forensic ident photographed the scene and searched for clues. Police had an excellent description of the gunman's semi-automatic weapon.
We then knew that the number of shots had been fired was inside the store, and with a semi-automatic firearm. So we concentrate our first efforts in locating any type of shell casings, which may have been ejected from the gun.
At the Center of Forensic Sciences, a ballistic expert checked the casings under a comparison microscope. All seven rounds were .22 caliber, all fired from the same gun. Natalie Pardee had witnessed the start of the holdup. She ran to push the panic button in the back room and came back just as the gunmen were leaving the store. The incident had taken less than a minute, but the nightmare would last forever. Daniil Thomas's nightmare was about to begin. Police had traced a license plate on the getaway car back to her husband, Ken. An officer dropped by around 10 and asked if Ken was home. When Daniil said he wasn't, she was told that Ken's car had been used in a nearby robbery and murder. What they didn't tell Mrs. Thomas was that they were suspicious Ken might have been one of the balaclava gunmen. She kept thinking whoever had committed the crime had stolen Ken's car. She expected Ken would show up at any minute or phone her asking to be picked up somewhere. She sat up the whole night waiting. The next day, police found Ken's car in a lot about a 5-minute drive from the gun shop. They checked out the trunk, fearful they might find Ken's body. They did find traces of blood on the passenger side. Was it Ken's? Greg McAllister, one of the IDENT officers, had a hunch. He returned to the scene of the crime.
In examining the gun cabinet, you can see that the glass is about a quarter of an inch thick. Any person, regardless of the garment they're wearing, is certainly running a risk of cutting themselves.
For the next 3 hours, he went through every piece of glass, visually inspecting each one. Finally, he hit pay dirt. On 3 pieces, he found small trace amounts of blood. A sample was sent to the biology lab at the Center of Forensic Sciences. A DNA analysis of that blood was compared to the blood sample found in the getaway car. They matched. Investigators now knew it came from the taller perpetrator. But if the blood wasn't from Ken Thomas, where was he? Had he been involved in the robbery homicide? Or had he been kidnapped? Or worse? Just how did Ken Thomas fit in with the two mass killers? 10 days after the murder of her husband, Natalie Pardee was allowed back into their gun shop. Now, the irony of their owning a gun shop in Canada is that they had never even considered keeping a gun for protection. A cleanup crew had been sent in after the police had collected all the evidence they needed. But there were still traces of blood where Roger had been shot. Daniil Thomas, meanwhile, was dealing with the pain of waiting. He'd been last seen near the bank around noon on the day of the robbery murder. Police had received reports that Ken's car had been spotted near the gun shop around 2. Then again at 3, and again at various intervals up until 5. But Ken Thomas had not been identified as one of the occupants. At night, Daniil heard Ken's key in the front door. Heard his familiar footsteps on the stairs. Heard him open the door to the bedroom and ask if she wanted coffee or tea. but it was only a trick of the mind. Something between sleep and hope. Investigators started checking out some of their most notorious criminals, local bike gangs, and known drug dealers. Surprisingly, these groups were more than willing to prove their innocence by providing blood samples and polygraphs. So who were the gunmen?
It seemed that every time you went around a corner, there was more information to be investigated, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger.
It was like you were in a marathon, and you went home exhausted every night, knowing full well that the families would want to know at some point how it was going and what you were doing.
By November, Natalie Pardee had started working in the gun shop again. It still held wonderful memories of her and Roger, and she found it comforting, as if Roger was still there. But by November, police cautioned Danielle that her husband was probably dead. But she refused to give in to despair, refused to give up hope. Then on January 21st, almost 4 months after the robbery homicide, a fisherman near Lake Ontario discovered a body in a fenced-in bird sanctuary. Was it Ken Thomas? A pair of work boots stood nearby, and a pair of jeans had been thrown on the body. A winter storm was coming in off the lake so quickly, it seemed the investigators might not get a chance to properly examine the site. They scrambled to erect a tent.
Within minutes after getting the tent set up, it began to snow. If in fact, there's little doubt in my mind how we not got the tent set up at that time, the remains of this person would have been buried in snow for months, and we may not have uncovered him until spring or summer.
Inside the tent, the ident officers could study the dead body.
His face and hair had virtually decayed away just from the exposure to the elements. In examining his skull, it was quite obvious that he had suffered gunshot wounds or head injuries, which, viewing, were definitely gunshot wounds to the head.
Sensing that it had been an execution-style murder, detectives called in Ontario's deputy chief coroner.
There was one to the left side of the skull, which entered roughly in this region. Two bullets entered and formed a conjoint or joined entrance wound a little to the front of this other wound. Within the skull, there was one bullet recovered, and there were two exit wounds located on the right side of the skull.
There was also a significant wound in the back half of the C1 vertebrae.
It would have involved the spinal cord, resulting in immediate incapacitation, and thereafter travels into the back of the facial bones and exits likely from the nose area.
Embedded in the dirt under the body, investigators recovered a bullet. Under a comparison microscope, it matched the bullets that had killed Roger Pardee. But it was the detective's last observation that would be particularly chilling.
I saw his watch still running, but it was an hour off. We had switched to daylight savings time by that time in January. When Mr. Thomas went missing, it was still standard time.
Investigators now surmised that Ken Thomas's killers had carjacked him at the bank and driven him to the bird sanctuary, where he'd been forced to scramble under the fence. Then they ordered him to remove his clothes, saying this was so he couldn't follow them. As he was taking off his shirt, they shot him. Then shot him three more times at very close range on the left side of his temple. The scenario was horrific. It suggested that Ken Thomas had likely been murdered hours before the two gunmen staged their brutal holdup. It also meant that during all the months that Danielle had hoped and prayed for her husband's safe return, he'd been dead. But investigators had hit a wall as far as the clues to the identity of the gunman. It was time to start looking outside the region. They could be anywhere in Canada, anywhere at all in North America.
There'd be nights you'd go home and you'd sit in front of the fireplace, or you'd sit quietly, look out the window, and you'd kind of methodically go through your investigation. and think, is there something we've missed? Have we missed something so obvious? Maybe we should go in and go in this direction. And you're constantly doing that.
You live, eat, and breathe this investigation.
As the saying goes, if you have a gun in a drawer in Act One of a drama, it's sure to go off in Act Three. The same can be said of a stash of 11 stolen handguns. They were bound to go off somewhere, sometime. 6 months after the murders and a three-hour drive away, a woman called the London, Ontario police and said that two gunmen were planning an armored car robbery and intended to kill all three guards. The police took the woman very seriously. There had been a rash of violent robberies over the past 5 months involving two armed, masked men the police had dubbed the Balaclava Bandits. Police set up surveillance. They watched the men pile into a stolen van. They were no longer gunning for an armored car. Instead, they pulled up in front of a supermarket. One gunman stayed close to the door. The other two went inside where they wounded one man and robbed the safe.
Less than a minute later, they were back out of the business. They were carrying a couple of bags at that particular point, got back in the motor vehicle, and started to drive away. The surveillance units waited until they had an opportunity where they could approach their vehicle as to what they call a mobile takedown. And it was at that time that they were able to effect that and got the vehicle stopped and made an arrest of all three individuals.
The three men taken down were Ronald Woodcock, a career criminal with a long rap sheet, Roshan Nurizali, a deserter from the Iranian army, and Derek Thompson, a childhood friend of Woodcock's. Were these the same men who murdered Roger Pardee and Ken Thomas? At this time, suspects could refuse to give police blood samples. Woodcock and Nurizali refused, but quick-thinking investigators realized Nurizali's knee had been scraped in the takedown and seized his pants. The blood cake genes were rushed to the DNA lab at the center. It gave investigators the break they needed. The sample on the genes matched the DNA of the blood in the gun case and on the armrest of the getaway car. They now knew Roshan Nurizali was the second gunman, the one who had smashed the gun case. But who had been the first, the one who had murdered Roger Pardee? Natalie Pardee and other witnesses testified that the first gunman was the shorter of the two, somewhere around 5'5". That fit both Woodcock and Thompson. Derek Thompson had an ironclad alibi for several of the London robberies. But what really helped eliminate Thompson was that he had glaucoma, which made his ability to see through a balaclava more problematic. So he cut small eye holes. In no other day robbery had any of the balaclava bandits cut eye holes. Derek Thompson was not implicated in the murders of Roger Pardee and Ken Thomas. Eventually, he would be sentenced to 10 years for armed robbery. What investigators really wanted was to get Woodcock and Nurizali on first-degree murder charges.
There's different levels of robberies that we see. There are those that will go in and just hand a note. There are those that will pretend they have a weapon. There are those that will have an imitation of a weapon or a knife. There are those who will go in with a gun. You'll have those that go in and fire a shot into a ceiling as a warning shot and then rob. And then you have people at the highest level where they come in balaclavaed with the intent to shoot and kill if necessary to commit a common purpose.
It would all come down to the stolen handguns. Three handguns had been recovered in the London takedown, Investigators needed to prove they were the exact guns that had been stolen from the party's gun shop to really nail Woodcock and Nuorzelli.
Circumstantially, if you gave the evidence to a jury or to just anyone, circumstantially you'd come to a conclusion that they are the same guns. But it isn't as good as saying that is the gun, and the thing we were missing from these weapons were the fact of the serial numbers.
That's when investigators used the Magnaflux process. But the serial numbers on these guns had been filed off.
I'm going to use a simple horseshoe magnet. The process itself is very dependent on the position of the magnet, so that the serial number, the area where the obliteration occurs, is between the two poles of the magnet. Now, the Magnaflux, in this case, just comes in a ready-made solution, and it's iron filings mixed with our mineral oil.
Not only did investigators hope to make the serial numbers appear, they intended to do it in court, in front of a jury.
But just from what I can see here, what appears to be a 4, and then this looks to be a D. After that, we see what appears to be a 7. 0 and a 1.
The serial numbers match two of the guns stolen from Roger Pardee's handgun cabinet. When the jury gasped at the demonstration, investigators smiled. Given the cold-blooded, calculated nature of Roger Pardee and Ken Thomas's murders, Ronald Woodcock and Roshan Nuorzelli were both convicted of first-degree murder. In Canada, which has no death penalty, they were each given the maximum sentence, life.
I made a promise to the Pardee family, especially to one young boy who was just a young teenager. I promised him that we would get these guys for his father.
When it was all said and done, and you're outside the courtroom, and the victim's family, particularly the daughter of Mrs. Thomas, and the two boys of the gun shop owner, when they give you the hug and the handshake, and you know it's heartfelt thanks, I don't think it can get any better than that.
What Natalie Pardee and Daniil Thomas lost can never be measured. What they found is that for a few misfits who don't give a damn about human life, there are so many who do. The stories on Exhibit A are based on actual cases. The names of the guilty are real.